Hi, everyone. I'm Brian Kiley.
I'm Joshy.
And this is Engaging Culture, a podcast presented by Bridgeway Christian Church. On today's episode, we're going to talk about former Nebraska Senator Ben Sasse. He's facing a terminal cancer diagnosis and is talking about all sorts of interesting aspects of life and faith and what it means to be an American. And we're going to discuss some of his thoughts, all of that and more on this episode of Engaging Culture. All right, here we are, Engaging Culture Podcast. Josh, how are you?
Here we go. I have had the worst allergy stretch in the last, 2 weeks.
It's
been awful. It's been great.
It has been a rough allergy time.
I don't know what bloomed with all this rain, but bring back the drought. I cannot handle whatever's blooming in my neighborhood is trying to murder me.
The wind cannot... I mean, that doesn't help either.
No, it's really not.
Yeah.
Other than that, things are great.
Other than that, you're great. Okay, good, good. Yeah, well, I'm guessing the allergy, I don't have allergies, so I merely...
All right, episode over. I'm
feel
done.
Feel sad for those who do. I'm doing fine. Tell me, I'm guessing the allergies were not the best thing you saw last week, so what was it?
Well, I've got a twofer. I've gotten back into some hobbies, one of which is roasting my own coffee, which I love to do, but I've had a broken roaster. And then for my birthday, people threw some money together and I was able to replace it.
Nice.
Fantastic. Been roasting coffee. It's been going great.
All right.
Really fun. I also bought a too expensive barbecue.
Okay.
Now, for those who are worried about my budgeting practices, I sold a lot of other things in order to pay for it, so it wasn't just out of pocket. Anywho, I love this thing. It's a Master-Built gravity charcoal grill. It smokes and grills and gets up high enough that you can use it as a griddle. It's kind of an all-in-one thing.
Wow.
It tastes better because it's not gas. It is fantastic. I love the thing. Our first cooks went amazing. Our kids were going for thirds and fourths.
Wow. What'd you make?
The first one was tri-tip, when you're getting going, that is the most forgiving meat to cook.
Yep.
And we did one with the dry rub and one with the marinade, and both turned out absolutely fantastic. It was high quality. Love it.
All right. Roasting coffee and grilling meat.
That's right. What else do I need in life?
I mean, hey.
Other than a cardiologist.
Apparently. all right. Well, my best thing was I just have to go this last Mother's Day. We were hosting both sides of our family, which I... I have some memory of in the last few years. I think there was once that my parents came over to my in-laws' house. But in terms of having brothers and sisters and all of that all together from both sides, I cannot think of a time where we've done that.
Oh, wow.
And I think just the sense of, okay, we're going to have both sides together. And people, I have pleasant people on both sides of my family. But when we get together with my family or with my wife's family, it's a very different experience.
For sure.
You're hosting in your home, so there's this sense of how's this going to go, right? And I am a bit of a catastrophizer to begin with. So
no way!
I know. This is shocking to you, Josh, but it was great. We had a fun time. There was lots of laughter. There was good conversation. Everybody got along. The cleanup to prepare was something, but it wasn't horrible. It took a minute to kick my wife out of the kitchen and have her just go relax after it was done so we could clean up and not her, reminding her it is neither Father's Day nor Son's Day. So the fact that we helped set up is irrelevant. She needs to go relax.
And here's the thing. Every day is Son's Day or Daughter's Day.
Pretty much.
That is our lives as parents.
That is an excellent point. So it was just one of those times where... when everyone left, we all kind of took a breath and we're like, hey, all right, that was great. So
that's cool.
Fun to get to honor, obviously, my wife and my sister-in-law and my mom and my mother-in-law. So we had a great time. So that's very, very grateful for that. We'll be right back. We are back, and it is, of course, not a terribly uncommon thing to hear about a celebrity or public figure who has died or become gravely ill. And that type of news is always really sad. But I'll be honest with you, Josh, it is fairly rare that hearing about something like that really gets to me, where I go, oh my gosh, no. And when I heard about Ben Sasse, former senator from Nebraska, former president of the University of Florida, that was one of those, oh no, I can't believe this
right.
sort of things for me. Late last year, he was diagnosed with terminal pancreatic cancer. Thanks to a new experimental drug, he's been able to extend his life by several months. He was given 3 or 4 months to live, and it's been something like 6 months now, and they're saying he may even make it to a year. And he's chosen to spend part of that time doing media interviews, talking about America, talking about facing death, and he is a strong Christian, and he's talking a lot about his faith. And I want to preface what I'm about to say here by saying there are a ton of members of Congress who I know literally nothing about.
Right.
But I don't think I could name one from either party that I'd go, man, I really respect them in terms of how they carry themselves in office and steward the responsibility that comes with the job.
Yeah.
But Sass, back when he was a senator, I mean, he's someone who I don't agree with on every or even a good number of issues. But he is somebody I deeply respect.
Yeah.
As a person who values thoughtfulness over agreement, I am a big fan of his. He's the author of literally one of the most important books I've read in my lifetime, Them, Why We Hate Each Other and How to Heal, which I quoted extensively during our 2024 Faith and Culture series on Christianity and American politics. And he's one of the very few politicians I've seen in the last decade that really seems to take seriously the responsibility that comes with political power. In fact, I remember back when he was in Congress, I would listen to his speeches and the things he would say on the Senate floor, and I would just think to myself, dude, you are way too good for this. Like, you are an actual human who cares about America, who doesn't want to play a bunch of games. I mean, he called the United States Senate to be what it's supposed to be, the greatest deliberative body in the world. And it was obvious that he really cared, first and foremost, about serving God and telling the truth. And second, about taking his job as a senator really seriously. Now, sure enough, he quit before his second term was up because he thought he could make a bigger impact outside of what he saw as a very unserious Congress. In fact, I loved this line. He referred to Congress recently as Instagram for middle-aged, not very attractive folks.
That's a pretty decent burn.
Which, like, how sad that is what he refers to. That is his observation of what the Senate has become. Now, one of the most watched interviews Sass has done is with Scott Pelley on 60 Minutes. And Pastor Josh, I want to talk about a few big themes that he covered in that interview, and then we'll close with what Sass can teach us about kind of a Christian view of death. So, first topic for us, he laments a lot of what he sees in our current political culture, and there's certainly plenty to lament. He says that too many politicians are interested in quote-unquote fan service and social media sound bites than they are in solving longstanding problems. Do you think that's a fair assessment? And if so, what are the effects of that?
You know, from the outside looking in, I think that's fair. From somebody who is actually inside that to say that, I think that would probably be more than fair to say that, yeah, he's right. During that interview, he brings up the fact that TV cameras in the Senate have actually made things more difficult. And he's not arguing that we shouldn't have transparency. We should still have lots of reporters there reporting on what's going on. But this idea of being seen and notarized, that's not the right word, but noticed, and just essentially exalted because fundraising is so important. Part of the downside of doing small fundraising pitches, now that we're doing kind of the micro approach where people are giving $20 each versus the giant conglomerates, is that you have to sell yourself over and over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And so I don't necessarily blame senators or congresspeople for getting into that space. However, there should be a lot more accountability because what ends up happening is that we're not governing. We're trying to one-up one another. We're trying to get notice. We're trying to get eyeballs. And that's not what we're really aiming at. And he goes on to talk about how they're not talking about the problems in the future.
Yeah.
They're only talking about today. And that is not a way to lead a nation.
No, it's not. And the performative element of politics is really, really troubling to me. And you're right. On some level, you go, well, this is just how the game is played. And it's what you have to do if you're going to survive. And that's a problem. But the real challenge of that is it's one of the many factors why we have some really, really unserious people in quote unquote public service right now who are approaching things like legislating, fulfilling, you know, one of the three branches of government, not as a place to go and solve problems. And you're entering into things like hearings and debates, not trying to really get to the root of something, but to be able to create a soundbite that can go viral on social media. Right. I mean, he's not a member of the legislative branch, but, you know, I had the unfortunate displeasure of watching a little bit of the Senate hearing with Kash Patel yesterday, who is such a deeply unserious man. And the idea that he is a director of the FBI is just crazy. Right. But you listen into the defensive nature of the way he's answering questions or evading questions and all of that. And you're just going, like, What are we doing here? Like this, like where are the adults in the room, right? Who can actually talk about serious issues without trying to just own the person asking the question or again, try to create something that you put on social media. And I don't know, when that is how we're approaching governance, it's not a partisan thing. I think everyone loses.
Yeah, I see it as this. We're trying to turn our government into a TV show. It's now governing for entertainment as opposed to actually trying to lead people. And something that he talks about is that the political dysfunction that we see in Washington isn't the root of America's problems, but is the result of our thinning of local communities. How do you think that's connected?
I thought that was a really interesting point that he made, that it's actually not – the problems don't start in Washington. In many regards, Washington is a reflection of deeper problems that exist within our local communities. So we don't know our neighbors, which that's kind of a standard challenge in most neighborhoods in America. And because of that, we don't have a ton of personal relationships. So a lot of our quote-unquote interaction is happening online. And that interaction is – increasingly one way. So I'm not conversing online. I am viewing content online, which there's a place for that. I'm not anti-viewing online content. But the problem is I don't have personal relationships with people who disagree with me on a range of issues. And we're not connecting on things independent of those issues. Like even my next door neighbors on either side, I know decently well.
Right.
Like we don't talk about culture war stuff. We don't talk about politics. We don't, you know, we talk about, I don't know, regular life stuff. And there is a decrease in that. So what's happening is we're educated through screens, so our information is disembodied.
Right.
We're educated by people who want to convince us that really divisive issues ought to be at the center of our lives. And then that is creating in us a desire to support and platform politicians and leaders who are not people capable of intelligent and nuanced conversation. They're people capable of owning the other side, creating clever sound bites, and just sort of being these performers as opposed to serious legislatively minded people.
Do you think that has anything to do with a deep rooted desire and maybe hole within ourselves of that we need community? So we're looking for ways of like essentially forming our own tribe that we can be a part of something?
Yes, absolutely. And I would use the metaphor of we all need food. And instead of seeking out whole food, which would be human relationships and community, we are gorging ourselves on the processed food of online.
Delicious Lay's.
Yes, that's right. We are neck deep in Takis and Doritos. Stuck on our screens, being formed in some really unhealthy ways. And I don't know if you know this, Josh, attracting attention on the internet is a different skill set than building friendships, than negotiating, than learning how to compromise. And we're giving an awful lot of our attention to online personalities and starting to view that as normative. And we're not giving nearly enough attention to building everyday relationships.
Could you imagine your neighbor walking over to you and essentially talking like an Instagram post to you?
Hey, guys.
Hey, guys, let me show you my five favorite golf swings.
Yeah.
Like who talks this way?
Nobody.
Where it's like, look at how knowledgeable I am, where it's all self-aggrandizing.
Yeah.
Because I've been around self-aggrandizing and self-absorbed people that all they can talk about is life through their lens, where they cannot, they're not asking questions about you. They're not asking, you know, they're not curious about anybody else or for anything else. And this lack of curiosity kills community.
It does. It does. And the internet is largely not a place for curiosity. It's a place to reinforce what you already think. He says that when voters look to Congress today, the picture they see is a lot of self-serving, hyperbolic language, but limited substance.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I think that is largely true. Now, one thing I really appreciated about him is he talks a lot about sort of the, I don't think he uses this word, but the almost sort of miracle of George Washington and how he voluntarily surrendered power when he could have been made a king.
Yeah.
And then even the Adams Jefferson transition, where you had the opposite party win an election and there was the peaceful, he may have used the word miracle to describe this, the peaceful transfer of power, the idea of kind of, there was the assumption that America was going to, oh, I guess we're going to have a civil war now because someone else wants to be in power.
Right.
But they were able to step aside. John Adams was able to step aside and create this tradition of a peaceful transfer of power. What's the point? He makes it clear that he's really, really down on this idea of political power, or really power in general, being your primary identity marker. If George Washington's primary thing was power, he never would have stepped down.
Yeah.
Right? But he was motivated by something beyond that. And what Sass says is that our callings as spouses, parents, and friends should be much more important to us than having power.
Totally.
Why does that matter?
It changes the way that we engage with this world. I thought Scott Pelley's question and how he phrased the question was he knows senators who like would die if they didn't have the title of senator. Like it would crush them to their core.
Yeah.
When we place our identity in these things that ultimately don't last, they do matter, don't get me wrong, but they don't last. Beyond this life, they don't last, and they don't have a lasting legacy that really matters at the same level that being a loving spouse, a doting father, somebody intrinsically tied to everything that is community has. We begin to isolate and make ourselves the center of our own universe. And Ben Sass actually talks about his temptation, especially early on, that he wanted to make himself the center of his worship and his idea. It's easy to do to think that. And I thought it was just so remarkable how he then said, he said that should be like the 11th calling, and maybe the 6th, you know, that there's all these other things that are so much more important than power.
Yeah.
And I thought that was incredibly insightful. How about you?
The idea of going, what is power for? And I think we have gotten to a place in society where we have overly normalized the idea that power is this intrinsic good in and of itself. Mm. And that is really dangerous for lots of reasons, not the least of which is that is not a Christian view of power. A Christian view of power views power as influence for the purpose of service. Mm. What does Jesus say? The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. The point of power is blessing.
Yeah.
Like the point of power is leveraging that power in the service of those who do not have it. And when that is the view of, like, those are the types of people I want in power. I want to elect, like, honestly, like, this is like completely honest. Before I care about party, because you know how down I am on
either political
side.
Parties, yeah.
Before I care about party, I want to know, are we electing people who understand the purpose of power, that the purpose of power is to serve your community. Mm. And I think when you can have that view of power, it is instrumental. It is not intrinsic. It is instrumental to a greater purpose. It is not the great purpose in and of itself. So the idea of going, I want to be a great husband. I want to be a great father. I want to be a great friend. And should I have the opportunity to take on greater power, I want to leverage that power for the good of my family, for the good of my friends, for the good of my community, not in like a nepotism kind of way, but in a sense of going, this is a service thing. And I think this is something, Josh, for all of us, you don't need to be elected to Congress to have that view of power. I mean, you and I have power. Yeah. Most people have some sort of power. And to go, the point is not to make me feel great about myself. The point is to use that in service of those who don't have it.
Yeah, and I would take that even a bit further, that when our ultimate goal is just to be powerful, what we're saying is that we want to be God.
Yeah, that's good.
And we are seeking the power of a God-like deity within ourselves, that we want the influence, not to help others, but to have others serve us and to see how great we are.
Yeah.
I know pastors like this, so this is not unique to the secular world.
Nope.
I know parents like this. I know... you know, growing up, I had a friend who shall remain nameless, because probably not super thrilled at this, but his father was such a narcissist that he wanted to have sons, and he told his people this. Like, he was not ashamed of this at all. He wanted to have sons so because that was the how people viewed how great he was.
Wow.
Like, wasn't even embarrassed to say that in public to other people. It's like, oh no, I have sons because of my greatness.
Okay.
And he was incredibly,
like, what does that get? Like,
I don't know. He was incredibly successful financially. And so he just had all of these, like, I am the center of this universe. And it tore his family apart. Like, I don't know that he has any relationship with his family anymore.
Yeah.
Because who would want that?
And I'm not a therapist, but I have to imagine that underneath that is this like deep-seated insecurity that says, I need to be powerful so that... And here's the thing. I mean, that's an extreme example.
Yeah.
But I think for all of us, if we view power as this like absolute good, or we make it our North Star, there will never be enough.
Yeah.
There will never...
Totally.
You'll be paranoid that you're going to lose what you got, and you're going to always need more. And we need people serving in all levels of leadership. I mean, I always say I don't want to follow a leader who has to lead.
Yeah.
I want to follow a leader who is gifted to lead, who feels a calling to lead. But when somebody goes, I have to have this position for my identity, for my ego, or whatever, like that. I don't know.
That's one of the things that I really do appreciate about our senior leadership team is I don't get the sense that anybody on that team needs to have that notoriety. Even Pastor Lance, who's got a lot of influence, and he has a very strong sense of his calling.
Yeah.
But the amount of times that I've seen him step aside to allow somebody else to do something,
totally.
Or to lead something, or to change something, just keeps reinforcing this idea that he does not have to be the one to make every decision and to do everything. And I think that's a great model for us as leaders, but also for us as a church, that none of us have to be the all-powerful person here.
Yeah. And we can, again, devote sort of our primary attention to something beyond just that, getting more power for ourselves.
Absolutely.
Now, to shift gears to our next topic, he spoke quite a bit about AI and the digital revolution. And I thought it was really interesting when he was asked if AI would lead to heaven or hell, he said yes. and he said that he fears that AI will lead to a crisis of meaning. And this is something I've actually thought about quite a bit. As AI can do so many jobs for us and can do so much of our thinking. And he said, at the level of consumption, we're all going to have lots and lots of stuff because AI is going to make it easier to have stuff and going to make stuff cheaper. But at the level of human meaning and production, it's pretty scary not to know what you're going to do to add value for your neighbor in 10 or even 25 years from now. I think he's onto something there.
Yeah.
And it's a big reason why I use AI on most days, but I try to keep pretty tight boundaries around it, and even will often reflect on maybe how much I used AI to help me with a particular task.
Mm-hmm.
And there are times where I've gone like, I'm a little uncomfortable with how much I relied on AI there. So I guess I'm getting to the point of I recognize the temptation and I recognize the power and the benefit, but I also see there's a real crisis of meaning that can come if we're just asking AI to do all of our work for us, because sort of intrinsic in human nature and even being an image bearer of God is work and production. how can we protect against AI creating this sort of crisis of meaning?
You know, I don't honestly know how we do it on a macro level, but on the micro level, on the individual piece, I would say remembering that God gave us the calling and directive to produce and cultivate before the fall.
Yeah.
That work is not a result of the fall. That it's that God's perfect design for humanity isn't to sit around and do nothing.
Yeah.
That, and I think that's why there's so much angst when we don't have productivity. When I was in my early, late teens, early 20s, mm-hmm. There was a season where I didn't have a job. I wasn't going to school, and it was the most depressed I had ever been in my life.
Yeah.
And talking to people about it, it's like, I'm not stressed because I have so much going on. I'm stressed because I have nothing.
Yeah.
I have nothing of value to add. I'm embarrassed for myself. Mm-hmm. And I don't, but it's like, it was a level of depression where I couldn't even see how to take the first step to get out of it at that time.
And that's a whole different kind of stress than the like busyness stress.
And that lack of productivity was, if that would have gone unchecked, that could have ended me. And the nicest thing my mom did for me was tell me to move out.
Yeah.
Because it was like, oh, I will starve if I don't work.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
And she's like, I will help you get your first apartment. Good luck.
Good luck.
And then that was it. And then, so it's like, oh my gosh, I have to figure this out. So then I went back to school and I started working more, and all of a sudden just that simple amount of productivity changed my life because it gave me focus. It gave me something to actually achieve. And I think that goal-centric identity is really important because God gives that to us. And when we ignore that, we don't actually enjoy the things that we thought we did. Like it's not like I sat around and just loved playing video games all day and I was so fulfilled. I eventually stopped doing those things and I was just useless. Like making myself sound like a real treat here.
It sounds like a wonderful season of life.
It was not.
Well, and let's take that as sort of an analogy or allegory to AI, right? AI in this scenario is living at your mom's house.
Right.
A lot of stuff is just sort of handled for you.
I don't need to do anything.
You don't need to do anything. There's not a lot of financial obligation for you. You don't have a big to-do list, right?
Yeah.
But, and that was great for a short time, I'm guessing. And then it really wasn't pretty quickly. And you're lacking that sense of fulfillment and purpose that comes with doing work yourself.
Correct.
Right? And sort of being put in that position where you're forced to then step out and work was, like you said, it was the best thing for you. So I think there is a place for AI, much like if we're going to, you know, draw out this analogy further, there is a place for, say, parental support in the young adult years. That's a wonderful blessing. But to be able to say, no, we're actually made to work and produce.
Yeah.
And if we're not doing those things, sure, AI might be able to produce great things for us. You probably had a nicer living situation at your mom's house than you did in your first apartment.
quite a bit. Yeah.
But there's something that we're missing there. Another aspect of this is I really wrestle with the range of topics that I am seeking AI's help with.
Yeah.
I'm totally cool with AI help with research. If it can help me access research items quicker, great. If it can help solve a problem that I would have solved by going on the internet anyway, maybe how to fix something, or even I had Google Gemini make my training plan for the next race I'm doing, which was not going to be an instance where I was going to talk to a person about it anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
I think all that's fine. If we're replacing human interaction,
yeah.
Maybe instead of going to you, Josh, because I know you're an expert in some topic, I'm going to go ask AI. And now all of a sudden, the relational bond that gets built from just simple conversation or an invitation for you to share your expertise with me or just all of that, that is lost. And now I'm less connected relationally to you and I'm more connected to my device. You extrapolate that over the course of time. And now so many relational bonds are weak and I'm just looking at my computer all day long, that could be a real problem.
Absolutely. And if you really want to know the limitations of AI, research something you know a lot about.
Yes, that's very true.
And you're going to see how weak AI really is.
We're not quite there yet.
We're not there yet, and how not great some of the advice really is.
Yeah, no, that's true.
And so what's really dangerous is that AI convinces us that it's wise, and it's not wise. AI has no ability to have wisdom because wisdom is knowledge and proper practice.
Yeah.
And AI can give you some knowledge. Yep. It can give you some resources.
Yep.
But it can't put it into practice. One of the things that the Logos software has recently added is this AI research help.
Yep.
And it's fantastic because what it does is it just pulls up the content and helps you say, this is where I'm going to put my research time into.
Yep.
And so it really helps clarify what it is that you're doing, but it doesn't write things for you.
Yep.
It does not tell you, this is how you present it. Here's your new teaching. Here's your 5 points. It won't do it, even if you try, because the folks at Logos know this is dangerous.
Yeah, and you can't be writing people's sermons.
No, that is not the point. And so, but it does help. And so I think there is a role of AI to help us do things really well.
100%.
But we got to keep it in its proper space. And I like what you really said about the community piece, because I think that is also what's really dangerous, is as we see more and more of these stories coming out of people marrying their AI or trying to have relationships with this AI, these things that always reinforce our already held beliefs, we're really into dangerous territory.
Yeah, absolutely.
That this is so unhealthy as a culture to be drawn into these things. And this idea that AI is going to make our lives easier is true to some degree. But it's not going to do what people think it is.
Yeah.
How much time have you added to your life since you have a microwave and a washer and dryer in your home? You know, you just fill it with other things.
Right.
And so we're going to fill it with other things. And it's either we're going to fill our time with stuff that pleases us and makes us the center of our universe. And then we abandon the things of the Lord.
Yeah.
We abandon our community, or we utilize it as a tool so that we can invest into the community that's already around us.
Yep.
And so I think it's switching the way that we think about it. It's not replacing our tasks. It's allowing us to invest our time in better things, which would be community, not self-relaxation and self-pleasure.
Or doom scrolling and screens and all that other stuff.
Correct.
All right, that segment number one, we'll be back in a sec to talk about what he had to say about community and culture, and then ultimately some of his reflections on death. We'll be right back. Well, we are back, and one thing that Ben lamented in the interview was the collapse of community and culture. Specifically, he talks about the problems of generations not knowing each other, which, to be honest with you, Josh, is not something I've given a ton of thought to. But he says that one of the fundamental things that's wrong in America is young people don't know old people, and old people don't get to serve young people. Kind of this age segregation, he says, is a fundamental sociological problem. And he said that he sees social media kind of throwing gas on that problem.
Yeah.
Why is intergenerational connection something worth fighting for, and why do we need it in church?
So in my family, that intergenerational connection gave us a broader picture of our story, of the story of how our ancestors came from parts of Germany and Portugal as farmers and just slowly made their way across the United States, working in farm fields and then slowly building enough wealth to own their own farm.
Yeah.
Not wealthy, just
enough.
To start to own their own businesses. And that story of perseverance and that story of identity, like, reminds us of where we came from.
Yeah.
And that's really important because it's also within a church context, it reminds us of the goodness and faithfulness of God throughout the generations.
Yeah.
Oftentimes, we begin to see our own problems as nobody's ever experienced this problem before.
Yep.
Talk to somebody who lived through World War II and, you know, were drafted at 18 and sent off into a war they hadn't, like, no part in.
Yeah.
And, you know, seeing friends die, like, that is traumatic.
Yeah.
You know, talk to folks who are going through the protests of the Vietnam War, yeah, of, like, the tension that was in America at that time and what's going through, and seeing how this is not how it always is. And that perspective that we get from multiple generations of saying, yes, it's really bad right now,
yeah,
but it can turn around. We've seen it happen before.
Yeah. I also think related to that, you talk about this idea of, oh, I'm the only one to ever go through this. Even if we step away from big stuff, like remembering times in the past that were so much worse than now in so many different ways, just that concept of going, like, this is a well-worn path.
Yeah.
People have struggled with these things before. I mean, I remember just time, both individual and marriage counseling, going through both of those,
yeah,
things, like constantly reminding myself, I am not the only person to ever have this problem.
Right.
Lots of people have, and they have worked through it and made it. Like, the challenges that we're having in our relationship right now, we are not the first people to deal with this. Like,
right,
there are ways to go about it. There are people who can help. There are strategies we can use. And I think that generational perspective,
mm-hmm,
to see people who have wrestled with identity issues, to see people who have wrestled through challenging times in marriage, to see people who have wrestled with the real challenges of getting your first job and getting your feet on the ground career-wise, we need that level of interaction to help those who are younger kind of place what they're going through in perspective,
yeah,
not to minimize it, but to kind of keep from catastrophizing it. And then at the same time, I think older folks need younger folks,
mm-hmm,
for lots of reasons. The energy and vigor of younger generations, the being in touch with kind of new ways of thinking about different challenges in the world, you know, recognizing that, yeah, this is not the same world we had in the 80s or 90s or even 2000s, and it's worth adapting or at least understanding in some ways. I don't know. I think especially even in a church context,
yeah,
to be able to be around both people who have followed Jesus for longer than we've been alive, and for those people to have the opportunity to kind of be with newer believers or younger believers. I just think, yeah, there's a ton of mutual benefit there.
I think we also miss the opportunity to avoid some of the traps that generations before us have fallen into, because,
yeah,
they can teach us a lot to say, you know, in my 20s, I didn't think about retirement because I'm going to work forever. And then in my 70s, I am thinking about retirement quite a bit,
yeah,
because I'm now trying to live off of an income that was not suffice because I wasn't thinking about it early enough. You know, these kinds of things, while very secular, are also very important,
yeah,
and are good life lessons that we can be passing down so that we can assist the next generation to not take the same or make the same mistakes that we had.
Yes.
And then on the vice, you know, on the turn of that too, of younger generations have different parts of their culture that are valuable.
Yeah.
And being able to say, our generation is not the best generation of all time,
yeah,
that we can learn from one another is really great.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of things that I think we can take for some of the younger generation right now, where they desire to be in physical proximity with each other more than the one right before them,
yeah,
where that was very screen-centric. Screens are still a huge part, don't get me wrong,
yeah,
but that is not the whole. I am seeing them utilizing the screens to get in to community,
yeah,
again.
The pendulum is starting to swing.
It's starting to swing. And I think that desire to be with one another is really important, because I do think Boomer or X and like elder millennials was a very self-centered generations,
yeah,
about we're going to do this on our own. It's very individualistic societally, and it wasn't a community mindset at all.
It's, yeah,
I'm going to succeed, I'm going to do this,
yeah,
and my success is mine, and I can credit nobody else. And I don't think that's really healthy.
Yeah, No, I think you're absolutely right about that. And that kind of broader perspective, that intergenerational curiosity is critical to help kind of mitigate a lot of that stuff. I also really appreciated what he had to say kind of about love of country and patriotism. Mm-hmm. He says that we need to learn to love our country as something more than an abstraction. And he says we need to start more locally. And I loved this because I have never been into patriotism as an abstraction. I don't own anything red, white, or blue. I stand for the national anthem and I'm happy to do it. Hand over the heart's a little much for me. But I love America, but I don't, I'm not this like, again, I'm not into sort of the thin patriotism that has kind of a theatric element to it. I love American values. I love what America can be. I love America's place in the world. And I really resonated with what he had to say about kind of our brains aren't wired to love 330 million strangers. He says you have to learn in the little platoon you have, which is an idea he took from Edmund Burke, how to love real flesh and blood people that you can hug and that you can cry with and that you can break bread with. And then the maturity of that love can be transferred onto something larger like your nation. So the idea that we actually, one of the ways we love America is by loving the people around us and starting there and building kind of thick, real, deep community. And then on a macro level that, and in kind of a grassroots way, that creates a functioning, healthy democracy, a functioning, healthy country. I'm like, that approach to patriotism, like, I'm all in on that. Mm-hmm. I think that's really helpful. What are your thoughts on it?
I always get nervous about the worship of a nation versus the appreciation of a nation.
Yeah.
I appreciate America, and I appreciate the fact, and I'm very thankful that God has allowed me to be an American.
Yep.
Like, same. I still believe that it's the greatest nation, flaws and all, but it's still the greatest nation on earth.
Yes.
So I am very pro America, but I'm also very nervous about worshiping America over God, or that trying to fit God into an American ideal or bubble. And so this idea that he has of loving our community and the people around us as that's what's loving America is really beautiful.
Yeah.
And because I think about that within our cul-de-sac, that when we do our 4th of July celebration, it's not because we really love setting things on fire, but our whole community comes together and we spend time celebrating the common values that we have, and that freedom is a big part for us, and we really enjoy our time together as a small community and just loving each other. And I think that's a beautiful way of viewing patriotism, that it's actually our love for our neighbor. That's one of the most patriotic things we can do.
And it is so much deeper in its impact than sort of these more overt displays, which I'm not against the overt displays. I want to be clear. There's nothing wrong with that. Like wearing your flag colored stuff or, you know what, like, great, go for it. I'm not opposed to it.
No.
I'm simply saying that's sort of the decorations. The, like, the real heart of it is this deeper sense of loving your neighbor, loving your community, and seeking the good of the place where God has placed you. I think that's really, really important. Now, our last thing we're going to talk about, it's Sasse's reflections on his faith and his way of approaching death that were really fascinating and inspiring to me. He has accepted that he has a terminal diagnosis. In fact, when he went public with the news, he said he was going to die. Now, this clinical trial has bought him quite a bit more time than he originally thought, but his death in the next several months is extremely likely. By the way, he's also hosting a podcast that I think the title is Not Dead Yet or something like that, like the Monty Python reference. So he's got a bit of a sense of humor around all of this. He says that all of us are quote unquote on the clock in the sense that death comes for us. But he talks about the benefits of knowing his time is coming soon. He says that death is terrible, but that his impending death has forced him to think through things that are easy to ignore in the midst of everyday life. So just to quote him directly, he says, "Death is wicked. Death is evil. Death is not how it's supposed to be. And me getting a cancer diagnosis, again, is pretty small in the grand scheme of things. But he says, it's a touch of grace because it forces me to tell the truth. And the lie I want to tell myself is that I'm the center of everything and I'm going to be around forever and can work harder and store up enough that I can atone for my own brokenness. And I can't. That line, it's a touch of grace because it forces me to tell the truth. That was really moving to me.
Yeah, it's probably the most humble moment of that entire interview is the recognition that because death is close, he realizes that there's so much that is not in his control.
Yeah.
And there's so much that he depends on the Lord for. Mm-hmm. And while he's sad that he's going to be missing these incredible, like, it was very moving to hear him talk about missing different like milestones of his kids' lives.
Yeah.
And, but that reality of we're all on the clock. Yeah. We're all, he has the benefit of knowing that it's sooner. And so he can tell the truth. It's forcing him to say, my time is limited and I'm going to be about the Father's business.
Yeah.
That it's not about me.
Yeah.
And I thought that was incredible, to voice, especially in such a secular environment and interview.
Yeah. And the level of trust in God that he has articulated through all of this. And he comes from a very reformed, kind of very Calvinist tradition, which is not quite the stream that maybe you and I are in, but no. I mean, you know, all of these streams are 90%
still Christian, same,
still extremely Christian.
Yes.
And his acceptance of what appears to be his lot, I find to be very inspiring. Yeah. And this idea of I can trust God with the end of my life is a really powerful and profound thing. And I think the way that there is a balance here between you seek all the treatment that you can, you seek to extend your life through reasonable efforts, you pray, you ask God to heal. Like, these are all good and right things to do. Yeah. Certainly, if it were me or a family member of mine, we would do all of those things. There is absolutely nothing wrong with any of it. And at the same time, balancing that sense of all of us die.
Yeah.
Our hope is not ultimately in physical healing. Lazarus is dead, and to be able to face death and grieve death with resurrection hope, I just think that can be so, so powerful in not only allowing us to be healthy as we face that, but in the witness that it provides to other people.
Absolutely. I think the reality that what's next is incredible and even more likely, even more important than what is now, that this is all temporary. And to say that this is not the end,
yeah,
I think is incredibly powerful. And I think it's also really a beautiful way of viewing the end, that it's like, I've heard somebody say, it's a graduation. We're graduating to the next thing. And as a younger guy, it's like, that's stupid. They're dying. Like, let's just grieve death. But in a sense, there is a real beauty of that,
yeah,
of that. Being with the Father forever is the ultimate goal anyway.
Yeah.
And what comes next, while we will be sad about what we've lost here on earth, the Lord still makes whole.
Yeah. Years ago, I was in seminary, and we were talking about end-of-life issues. And we had this great discussion in one of my classes, and kind of the consensus in the room was they were talking about the challenge of end-of-life care in that it is incredibly expensive and often extends life for a small amount of time.
Yeah.
And again, the consensus was that perhaps Christians ought to be the one most willing to forego expensive medical treatment that will only extend our lives for a few days or weeks, so that medical resources can instead be devoted to those who have a chance to like really benefit, that, mm-hmm, that maybe that can be curative, or that, you know, kind of long-term healing is possible. In other words, that Christians should seek healing medical treatments when they're available, but we should be willing to accept death when it comes. And I remember I was talking to my dad about this, who is not a Christian and who is a physician. And he shared with me a story about a family friend of ours who was a colleague of his who I knew very well from just kids the same age, that whole thing. And part of this guy's job as a doctor was he was responsible for determining when medical care is futile. In other words, this is when actual attempts to heal should be stopped and the patient should be transferred to either hospice care or they should be unplugged from the machines. And often, making these decisions requires consulting with family members and sharing their loved one's fate, which, like, my goodness, that sounds like a terrible job.
Yeah.
I mean, this was 15 years ago, and I just don't think I'll ever forget. My dad told me that for this friend of his, who is a devout Roman Catholic, he said there was one group that was consistently the most difficult to deal with when it came to these sorts of medical decisions, and it was Christians. That in his experience, Christians are the ones who refuse to accept the inevitability of death, which made his job more difficult than it already was. That even if a loved one was in an entirely vegetative state, Christians would often refuse to allow that loved one to die. They would insist on being allowed to pray for a miracle seemingly indefinitely. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm all for praying for miracles. I believe in miracles. I believe God heals. I know people in our church who have been healed of, I know a person who introduced herself to me as, "Hi, my name is so-and-so. I have 1 year to live." That was over 10 years ago. She's still here and is doing great. Like, I've seen it. And that's amazing, right? And I don't mean to minimize how gut-wrenching a lot of these end-of-life decisions can be. But it strikes me as a theological problem if our Christian hope lies entirely in God's ability to heal and not in the resurrection. And I think that is something that Ben Sasse is modeling for us really, really well, that he has a hope in something beyond a cure for cancer, that it's actually a cure for death. And that when we know that, there is grief, there is tears, there is sadness. Like, I am not trying to minimize the pain of death or in any way suggest we ought not pray for healing. But to be able to approach death with that perspective, I think there's a real opportunity to glorify God in really powerful ways.
Yeah. Why do you think Christians of all people are so apprehensive with this concept of death?
Why Christians specifically is a tough one. I don't know. Stanley Hauerwas has this great quote that we're desperate to think that medicine will get us out of life alive. Right? And I don't know. Maybe there is a sense in which we have a little bit of an overrealized eschatology that our faith ought to save us from that level of earthly suffering. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on it?
I wonder if the kind of the teaching models of the, especially mid-90s to early 2000s, of that God's here to solve your problems has filtered into us so much that because death is a problem, that God's going to solve it by keeping us alive.
Yeah.
That ultimately, if we die, that means God's not faithful.
Yeah.
Or that we didn't have enough faith, even though we intellectually may not believe that. But I just wonder if that poor teaching infiltrated our hearts to such a level that we're only going to die if we don't have enough faith. Because if we're under 125, then we must be supposed to be living longer, you know? Yeah. I don't know personally. I also think, there's a Pollyanna view of what life with God is supposed to look like. And we forget that Jesus says we're going to suffer in this world.
Yeah.
And that pain is going to be a part of this world, that, Lazarus was risen from the dead. The poor guy had to die twice. Yeah. Like that, ultimately.
There's a shadow side to that.
There's
miracle.
A shadow side to that. Like, there's that is something that is a reality that we are going to pass. Yeah. And I don't think American culture we do very well. I really don't think in the Christian world we do really well, especially when it's everything's a celebration of life as opposed to a grievance of death. Yeah. Like, I think there are other cultures who really embrace the grieving process in a really beautiful ways that I think is actually really valuable. And I don't know that we're helping each other when we phrase everything around the positive of, oh, you know, celebration of life, it's not a sad thing. It's like, no, this is a very sad thing.
The sting of death is here right now.
Correct.
We can acknowledge that. There will be a time when we'll say death, where's your sting? But that time is not today.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Those are kind of my thoughts on it.
I think that's really good. So I mean, as we close, I think that the truth of the matter is none of us know how we're going to approach death until we get there. But I also think, as with so many things in life, the time to think through how we are going to approach something really difficult and grievous is the time to think about it for the first time is not when you're experiencing it. And I would hope that I would be able to face death with the same perspective that Ben Sasse is articulating. And I'm really grateful for his public witness. Yeah. I'm grateful for the way he is trusting God to fulfill the promises that God has actually made. Yeah. And man, he's just a great example for us all. So encourage you to listen to the 60 Minutes interview. Look it up on YouTube. Just Ben Sasse 60 Minutes. You'll find it. It's great stuff. Certainly an admirable, I think, voice for our faith, for kind of the beauty of America, for how to face death with just kind of sober-minded, Christ-centered reflection. And again, encourage you to listen to the interview. Thanks for listening. We'll be back in 2 weeks. Bye-bye. Thank you.